rights or powers of the United States, as well as those prescribing the terms or conditions of the grants of lands or other property therein made to the state of Alaska, are consented to fully by the state and its people. That means that in Section 6, they allowed them to select some lands. There were some provisions under which they could select them. They had to be vacant and unappropriated and adjacent to the first-class cities. And they had to agree to it fully, because it says in Section 8B3, in the event each of the foregoing propositions is adopted at said election by a majority of the legal votes cast on said submission, the proposed constitution of the proposed state of Alaska, ratified by the people at the election held on April 24, 1956, shall be deemed amended accordingly. In the event any one of the foregoing propositions is not adopted at said election by a majority of the legal votes cast on said submission, the provisions of this act shall thereupon cease to be effective. They had to agree to Section 4 of the Statehood Act, which they disclaimed forever all right and title to any of our properties, including fishing rights, whether those lands are held by us or held in trust for us by the United States. They had to agree that they would select only vacant and unappropriated land, and that land would be adjacent to the established communities, which were first-class cities in 1958. And if they did not agree to all of that, then the Statehood Act will thereupon cease to be effective. That means that it would have no force and effect in government or law. Then we move to Section 10 of the Statehood Act. Section 10A. The President of the United States is hereby authorized to establish by executive order or proclamation one or more special national defense withdrawals within the exterior boundaries of Alaska, which withdrawal or withdrawals may thereafter be terminated in whole or in part by the President. Section 10B. Special national defense withdrawals established under subsection A of this section shall be confined to those portions of Alaska which are situated north or west of the following line. And that line is called the Porcupine Yukon Kuskokwim line, PYK line. North and west of that line, the state has no jurisdiction, no force, no effect. Effective upon issuance of such executive order or proclamation, exclusive jurisdiction over all special national defense withdrawals established under this section is hereby reserved to the United States, which shall have sole judicial, legislative, and executive power within such withdrawals, except as provided hereinafter. The exclusive jurisdiction so established shall extend to all lands within the exterior boundaries of the withdrawal and shall remain in effect with respect to any particular tract or parcel of land only so long as such tract remains within the exterior boundaries of the withdrawal. The laws of the state of Alaska shall not apply to areas within special national defense withdrawals established under this section, while such areas remain subject to exclusive jurisdiction hereby authorized. The state of Alaska, the laws, its political subdivisions, all of it, do not exist in law. They are of no validity in law north or west of the Porcupine, Yukon, or Kuskokwim Rivers. during the continuance in effect of any special national defense withdrawal established under this section, or until Congress otherwise provides, such exclusive jurisdiction shall be exercised within each withdrawal in accordance with the following provisions of law. All laws enacted by Congress that are of general application to areas under exclusive jurisdiction of the United States, including but not limited to the generality of the foregoing, those provisions of Title 18 United States Code that are applicable whether within the special maritime and territorial jurisdiction of the United States, as defined in Section 7 of said title, shall apply to all areas within such withdrawal. In addition, any areas within the withdrawals that are reserved by act of Congress or executive action for a particular military or civilian use of the United States shall be subject to all laws enacted by Congress that have application to lands withdrawn for that particular use, and any other areas within the withdrawals shall be subject to laws enacted by the Congress that are of general application to lands withdrawn for defense purposes of the United States. To the extent consistent with the laws described in paragraphs 1 and 2 of this subsection, and with regulations made or other actions taken under their authority, all laws in force within such withdrawals immediately prior to the creation thereof by executive order or proclamation shall apply within the withdrawals, and for this purpose are adopted as laws of the United States, provided, however, that the laws of the state or territory relating to the organization or powers of municipalities or local political subdivisions, and laws or ordinances of such municipalities or political subdivisions shall not be adopted as laws of the United States.
Mr. Walsh, let's take a break for a few minutes and then mm-hmm. we'll come back to hear the remainder of your testimony. It's interesting, but it's something that I think justifies us taking a little break now. So about five
this
minutes.
Is the worst part of all this is the law. It's so boring, and yet it is so important. People have to follow the law. If you don't have the authorities following the law, you have that age-old saying that we do have the right to keep and bear arms against oppressive government, and it is our duty to uphold the law, even if the government doesn't.
Well, can I see your map, Bill?
Mm-hmm. I have some better ones, please.
Okay, well, let's start again.
Now, Section 10B4 of the Alaska Statehood Act provides all functions vested in the United States Commissioners by the laws described in this subsection shall continue to be performed within the withdrawals by such commissioners. Back before the Statehood Act, there was a United States Commissioner here who attended to the business. Name was Thompson. Warren Thompson. They said he was here forever. And he used to adjudicate the will and testament of the people, the landowners, and the inheritance. And if he couldn't find out immediately who was to inherit the land, well, he just processed the land into his own name for a dollar or whatever. He came by a lot of land like that. He also defrauded people out of land who didn't even die. He just got defrauded. Those records, I believe, are still in existence in the Fort Gibbon Recording District instruments in Fairbanks. However, when you look at his ownership any land transactions that he may have come into during the tenure of his office, he could not give to himself because that would be a conflict of interest. Therefore, his ownership of those properties are null and void. It seems that after the city was established and the state came north of the border and invaded, the rest of the magistrates followed his example in administrative procedure and picked up quite a bit of land around here themselves. After the Statehood Act was passed, five white men got themselves elected to the council, the Native Council of the Native Village of Tanana. They were all church members and preacher boys, and they all got on the council. They're going to do good for the Indians. The mere act of running for office was a federal crime. And to be elected and to sit upon the council was a federal crime. And then they voted as a Native council to create a state chartered political subdivision, which is inducing the Native people to convey the interest in their property, which is a federal crime. The city of Tanana came about under criminal circumstances and therefore has no validity in law. The only validity in law it has is criminal trespass. All of the unoccupied lots, whether they were patented and deeded or not, the state assumed jurisdiction over and sold at auction to non-natives or whomever had the money. In these circumstances, I'm sure that the five guys who were on there, since they all wound up with some land, benefited from such an act. Personally, I would have to call that racketeer-influenced corruption, or racketeer-influenced corrupt organizational activities. Those people are still alive, all except one, Curtis Edwards. And he died in a fire at the mission house in which the records were burned. Now, after the Land Claims Act, the Statehood Act in the history, that was when the problems began to surface as far as land ownership and use of the land, and who could do what, where. And the Native people were always in the way. In the case of the Rampart Power Project, it was the federal recognition of the people, more than any other factor, that stopped the Rampart Power Project. They could not just displace Native people when they already had ownership of their land and were recognized, had federal instruments to prove it. The rest of the conspiracy to gain control of Native property by these multinationals and other outside interests was furthered along by the Land Claims Act. But before we go into that, here is a copy of Title 43, United States Code, Section 859, which is Title 43 is the land laws of the United States. Section 859, it states, where lands have been or may hereafter be granted by any law of Congress to any one of the several states and territories, and where such law does not convey the fee simple title of the lands or require such patents to be issued, therefore, the list of such lands which have been or may hereafter be certified by the Secretary of Interior or such officer as he may designate under the seal of his office, either as originals or copies of the originals or records, shall be regarded as conveying the fee simple of all the lands embraced in such lists that are of the character contemplated by such act of Congress and intended to be granted thereby. But where lands embraced in such lists are not of the character embraced by such acts of Congress and are not intended to be granted thereby, the lists, so far as these lands are concerned, shall be perfectly null and void, and no right, title, claim, or interest shall be conveyed thereby. As we stated, the state of Alaska was allowed to select vacant and unappropriated lands, and that the patents of the United States would convey title to those lands. However, if those lands were not vacant and unappropriated or of the character contemplated by the Statehood Act, then they would not be conveyed. If they had already been owned and claimed by the natives, they are not of the character contemplated by the Act, and therefore they are not conveyed by such a patent. The Land Claims Act, Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, defines the public lands that the state and native corporations can claim. In the section marked definitions, which is section 3E, definition of public lands means all federal lands and interests therein located in Alaska, except, number one, the smallest practicable land as determined by the Secretary, enclosing land actually used in connection with the administration of any federal installation, and, two, public land means, and except land selections of the state of Alaska which have been patented to or tentatively approved to the state of Alaska pursuant to 6G of the Alaska Statehood Act as amended. Now, the land that the Statehood Act allows to be selected is public land, federal land in Alaska. And we have a law review proceeding over here. I won't dig it up. I can remember it. It states specifically that tribal lands are never defined as public lands or federal lands for the purpose of conveyances. So that just further goes to show that the law says that they cannot claim our land. The Land Claims Act withdrew the townships surrounding each native village from all forms of appropriation under the public land laws, including mining and mineral leasing laws, and from selection by the state of Alaska. Now, in the case of Tanana, we had a 1939 sovereign claim recognized by the federal government and valid in law. 1957, we exercised the Alaska Native Town Site Authority and created an Alaska Native Town Site, which was to be administered by the Federal Town Site Trustee and the Native Council. And it was to be administered according to strict fiduciary standards, which means that those lands could only be claimed by Native people because it is Alaska Native Town Site. The Statehood Act did not allow the state to come on this side of the river. However, those individuals did get on the council, and they did start the city. That was against the law. And the state could not have its jurisdiction here to claim anything. So at the time of the Land Claims Act, the exclusive occupation of this place by the natives was still effect in law. 1966, there was a land freeze. 1968, the land freeze was in effect here. And it has been in effect since then. It has never been lifted. You cannot lift the land freeze until there is a conveyance of this property. If you want to follow the law, according to the Land Claims Act, this is withdrawn from all forms of appropriation under the public land laws. It was frozen in 1966. There is no valid entries here other than the native town site. 1971, it withdrew it from all forms of appropriation, and it withdrew it from creation of third-party interests by the state. The state couldn't claim it, and the state couldn't make a third-party interest such as a city. And the city, it cannot convey land it does not own. This was withdrawn because the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act corporations are state chartered instruments. They cannot own, claim, or control native property any way whatsoever. And Congress doesn't have the authority to convey to those state chartered corporations any native properties whatsoever. Because as I said, Chief Justice Marshall ensured that they would not do that. In 100 years of change or 200 years of change, they knew that people would come to this point where they would try to take away what we own. However, and this document, if it's followed properly, doesn't allow our land to be claimed. The Declaration of Settlement, Section 4 of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, 4A, all prior conveyances of public land and water areas in Alaska or any interest therein pursuant to federal law and all tentative approvals pursuant to Section 60 of the Statehood Act shall be regarded as an extinguishment of the aboriginal title thereto, if any. So, the conveyance is made in the Act of 1884 shall be regarded as an extinguishment of aboriginal title thereto, if any. That's why the federal court had to uphold our claims, because it extinguished aboriginal use and occupancy and replaced it with statutory rights. 1939, we exercised another statutory right and got another statutory conveyance to a certain specific tract of land, which is 250-mile radius surrounding native village of Tanana. That prior conveyance was and shall be regarded as an extinguishment of aboriginal title thereto, if any. That means it wasn't touched by the Land Claims Act. This says all aboriginal titles, if any, and claims of aboriginal title in Alaska based on use and occupancy, including submerged lands, both inland and offshore, and including any aboriginal hunting, fishing rights that may exist, are hereby extinguished. We have to remember that those rights of aboriginal use and occupancy, including aboriginal hunting and fishing, were replaced by statutory rights and protection long ago, even before Statehood Act. And they apply here in Alaska completely. So they had to take these uneducated natives under their wing and teach them all about the Land Claims Act after it was passed, But the thing was, they didn't teach them the actual facts of the law. They taught them this way and that way and the other way so that the state could gain control of all the land. Now, they say natives don't own land. Corporations own land. In this place here, Tanana, they had a federal conveyance of the mission land, federal conveyance of the survey 2754, last native town site. They had other instruments of conveyance and title. And they're trying to say that they have no validity in law, that the state can acquire land anywhere, whether you own it or not, without paying it, and that these deeded town sites are now owned subsurface rights by Doyle Unlimited and surface rights by Tozitna, who shall, if it sees fit, if you're their buddy, they'll give you a use permit under Section 14C3 of the Native Claim Settlement Act, which is only a use permit. And after 1991, when 198 people go downtown for North America to get all looped up and sell their stocks during the annual convention, 198 people will convey 2% of the outstanding stock. The outside interests already have 49%, so they only need 2% to have control, and after that they don't give a shit who lives where. When they want this place, you gotta go. That wouldn't be so bad for some place like old Minto, where it got all messed up anyway and they should move out. But for this place, it's important, because from here, we have always owned this place, from the Gulf to the Prudhoe Bay, and from the Chukchi to Saskatchewan. And in this place right here, we have control of all the river systems. Starting up there where my sister lives is high ground and deep water. And it runs all the way down to NC Creek here. It's flat. It's just perfect for a deep water port and an industrial complex. And as soon as they can, they're going to move us. And the pattern so far has been moving people into places like Birch Park and Fairbanks, or that low-income state housing, or into these type of HUD houses that you see over here that are coming apart because they're not built to standards. Move them out of the way any old way they can at the lowest possible price. Products given to the lowest bid, cheap, 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 cheap. Lining the pockets of the contractors and the politicians and the whole works. See? I didn't mention, back, you guys heard of the Mad Trapper of what's that river? Albert Johnson, the Mad Trapper of, out there in Canada. He outran everybody, man. He outran everybody except some guy in an airplane. When the Russians were here, the reason why they said that they had nothing to do with the interior was because when they came up the Copper River, they got run out in a military operation. They came up and raped the women there and took off with all the property, and they came back for more. They got wiped out. They got one man sent back there to tell the tale. And when they came to New Lato, they got wiped out there, because they got a little too greedy. And when they were in Fort Yukon, they were not the Russians. These were the United States Army. They burnt Fort Yukon to the ground for overstepping their privilege. We have never been conquered here by war. So, the Army doctor in Fort Yukon writes to his superiors, there must be a peaceful means to conquer these people, for they are militarily too strong. And we haven't got the time, money, or manpower to come here and defeat them. And they used germ warfare. And they spread diseases among the people, and the elders died off within one season. And then they took the younger people and put them into missions. And the rest of them just had to stay there, and so they give them booze, let them drown their sorrows. And that set the pattern for today's generation. So there's people who won't speak out against white people because they were beaten in those missions and told, don't speak your language, don't practice your culture. You speak English, and you do what we tell you. And they're drunks. They can't do anything. And the elders, all their authority and teaching ended. So they come down to the point where we are today. Trespass, complete abrogation of our rights to land ownership, no recognition of the authority that is in writing, recognized in writing. This act here states specifically that it is not a jurisdictional act. It doesn't in any way diminish the authority of the Native Council. And jurisdiction does not turn upon ownership of the land. So our jurisdiction still extends 250 miles from this village, and all humans and all their properties are subject to us. There was a court case that talked about these townships, and James Fitzgerald said that the Native people don't have rights here that are enforceable. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled, yes, these places are withdrawn. They are not unoccupied. They are appropriated, and therefore they are not available selection by for the state or the Native Claims Settlement Act corporations. On May 15th, just a couple of months ago, Vonderheit, District Court Judge in Anchorage, escrowed the sand and gravel accounts and barrel which means that all this trespass is going to start to surface and all the people who are liable are going to pay. That Ninth Circuit court case stated that after the passage of this act, no non-Native person could acquire land within this town site. And there have been people acquiring land here. However, we do not know. But they are notwithstanding in law. Tozitna Limited cannot convey land because it does not have a conveyance. A tentative approval is neither negotiable nor transferable. City of Tanana has no validity here in law. It cannot convey land. The mission, the Episcopal mission, cannot sell that property to anybody because it states specifically in the act that gave it the use permit that when it ceases to be a benefit to the natives as a school or a mission, then the title reverts back to the natives. In 1952, the American people were in confrontation with the Russians, They had the Cold War. That was the term, the Cold War. In reality, it was a banking and financing move on the part of big business. The KGB and the CIA are both instruments of the banking system. On one spectrum you have communism, and on this other spectrum you have capitalism, and in the middle of it all you have bankers, the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers, the transnational corporations and unincorporated groups in private business, so private that they don't even have documents, and yet they control the wealth of the world. They took control of things. And in 1952, they were building this White Alice system here to ward off any attacks or to try and detect any attacks from the Russians. Because of the Cold War, the defense military system was under siege conditions here. They built a radar station, and they stocked it with every material that they thought they would need to sustain themselves in case there was a siege. They had barrels of toxic chemicals up there, which they used in the transformers and the rest of the electrical system. One of those toxic substances is called polychlorinated biphenyl. Another, which is even more toxic, is called carbon tetrachloride. Carbon tetrachloride was used in that vast electronic system to clean the components. They would clean the components and take that solvent out and dump it. The polychlorinated biphenyl is used as a cooler in the electrical transformers, and up there they had a lot of electrical generation for those huge antenna, radar antenna. They had a lot of that stuff, and if they had to change it in the transformer, they just took the oil and poured it into old waste oil which came out of the generators. They had no toxic disposal system. It was handled in a negligent manner, and it accumulated over the years. They left it in the dump up there, and from time to time the people in the city would go up there and get some oil and put it on the road to keep the dust down. After a while, they got the satellites launched and everything. They could look at everybody from one spot. Didn't have to worry so much about these places, so they just had them open until about 1978 or 79 or so, 80. And then they closed them down. They're going to abandon them. And in their waste disposal system, rather than take out these toxic substances, they just bulldozed over them. So the stuff is sitting up there in a dump with no containment and flowing into the waters, the watersheds, Bear Creek watershed and Mission Creek watershed. And after it was closed, the administration for the city criminally trespassed upon the site. They ordered some miners who they had going around oiling these roads to trespass on the site and gather up any drums that they could find there that had oil in them, even partially filled or whatever. And they brought those drums down and they spread them on the road for dust control. In 1980, Robert Mayo was working for the city, and he handled these 8 drums. And about 9 months to 14 months later, he was stricken with cancer. He was here last week, But he had to go to Fairbanks to get more checkups and more chemotherapy. We called attention to this last year. The government committed another crime, city, state, and feds, and covered up the contamination and the negligence. And they continued to do so until about 3 weeks ago, or a month ago. And the fellow who was running the safe water system back here, one Kurt Hediger, went and took samples from the road out here after the Air Force came to sample this place, took his own sample from the road and from the spreader they used to spread the oil, and they were both grossly contaminated. After the Air Force said there was nothing wrong. Now they're saying that the only two places that's contaminated is there and the spreader. And the only reason why they have to admit that is because he took those samples himself and he made them perform the test in front of him. Now, Sheldon Jackson held a meeting in San Francisco way back when, and in some hotel room or a hotel lobby or whatever in San Francisco, they divided our great state up into five different areas and gave them to five different denominations of the Christian sect to civilize the natives. They introduced Western medicine here to take away our use of the herbs and the old knowledge of medicine. And they took away the economic situation here and created jobs. It seems to me that in this whole line of events, the main thrust of it is to remove us so that we do not obstruct the taking of our properties. And if it means a little murder, who cares? We're so remote up here, nobody's gonna know. Just a few Indians, only 180,000. Cheaper to get rid of them than to feed them and build them houses. It goes all the way down today. They're saying Tozitna and Doyon Limited in the state of Alaska own land that has already been conveyed to us or even to some non-native people. And they're covering up the fact that they got this toxic waste here that's going to create cancer in everybody who gets polluted by it. You see, once you have been contaminated by these products, you do not have any protection from the cancer. Two 1/1000ths of one part per billion will cause a case of cancer in a human. And they're trying to tell us that 50 parts per million is considered contamination. And that they're going to act on grossly contaminated areas. And grossly contaminated areas are measured at 500 parts per million. If 2 1/1000ths of one part per billion will cause cancer, 50 parts per million is about how many million times more necessary to cause cancer? 5? 50? 500?
Well, they're your figures.
2 1/1000ths of one part per billion causes cancer. 50 parts per million is considered contaminated. What is that? 5 trillion times? So we have this, we have a trespass that goes beyond Alaska Native claims. Goes beyond that now, because that's the busiest place in town. And white people get contamination just like natives do. These streets out here, they're all contaminated. Because those boys who did all that told me all of it, see? Had to wring it out of them. But we have the details. Even to the point where they were described, it was described to them what PCB oil will look like. And oil contaminated with PCBs. And they said, yes, they put that in that big drum and spread it on the road. Wade Kellick, one of those guys, got some on his pants. Went home later on, took his pants off. He had a big old red rash right here. And the scientists themselves, the industry that created this stuff was going to cover it up. And they got these scientists last year in July to do a study. And the industry scientists came out with this study, and it said that these things are probably the most dangerous chemicals ever been created. The guys who were hired to cover it up, they couldn't. So the effect of the Claims Act, the effect of all of this business, is that government, in its great corruption, has come here and not only robbed everybody of their right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, but they're also creating a place here in this state, in 102 communities, the cost of a cure for cancer is approximately $1 billion. We need the 200 billion cubic feet of helium from the Riley Ridge gas formation in Wyoming. Has to be piped up to Prudhoe Bay and a feeder line to Barrow. We take the helium from the Prudhoe Bay oil fields, the helium from the Riley Ridge formation, and the gases in the South Barrow gas field. We may have enough helium to produce the kind of cryogenic unit we can use to conduct surgery with. Once we have the helium, we will have to have ample energy.
We'll talk closer to that thing.
The energy that is necessary to make this system cannot be generated by fossil fuels, because the fossil fuels must be used in the plastics and the different alloys that will be needed in the system. Therefore, we will need hydroelectric energy. We cannot have great hydroelectric energy projects like the Rampart Dam or Susitna. One reason is because they are situated in active earthquake zones, and another reason is because it's just too huge to do properly, and another reason is the cost. It's much wiser to use small streams that run all winter to create the kind of electric energy that we need, not only to provide power for industry and residential use in Alaska, but to provide the kind of power that it's going to take to make cryogenic surgery a reality. The minerals that are necessary to create the alloys are spread across Alaska, from the North Pole to the Gulf of Alaska, and we know where those zones, mineralization zones are. We know where the geothermal zones are that creates not only mineralization of the land, but also perennial flow of water for the electrification. When we harness this energy at these geological formations, we can also produce fish because of the warmth of the water and the high protein content surrounding these warm springs. We can also have high agricultural development. As I said in the beginning, the one thing that has sustained the humans here is the food. We're not corroded so much by the preservatives and everything else that they feed animals out there before they sell them. Take beef, for instance. Before they sell beef, they inject it with something that makes it hold the water in itself, so that 3 days before they sell it, they're going to feed it all this water, nothing else. When it goes to market, it's 500 pounds heavier than it would have been. Then you eat that stuff and it retains water in you and whatever else it does. We have to have fish. You can live on straight fish, nothing else. Of all the food in the world, man, fish and sea mammals are the most important food of all for people. Because with meat, you got to have plants, except for something like beaver or rats. So when we look at the development of the land here and the scheme that everyone is following, they're following this boom and bust economy, and they want to have immediate gain right now. They want all those minerals not to use in a system such as we wanted to have, not to have sustainable future and recyclable economics. They want to have gold and stuff like that so they could pile it up there in some room and look at it. Yep. The law says that we own this place. And whether or not we own it really is neither here nor there. When in the true sense of government, government jurisdiction does not turn upon ownership of the land. The force of government is something that goes above the land and above the people. And if the United States doesn't care to uphold its duties, I will. And if they cannot keep sovereignty of North America on this continent, I will. We don't need British Petroleum in Ohio to take 28% of the gross national product out of the United States, when 230 million Americans are beginning to starve because 2.5 years of disrupted weather patterns has caused the shortage of food. When they began to take the oil out of Prudhoe Bay, Richard Nixon committed a crime against the national security by ordering the helium to be vented into the atmosphere rather than contained, because they didn't want to pay the price to build a plant to contain it. The national helium policy makes it a crime to waste helium. And then the president says, vent it. And it's still going on today, and every subsequent president since then allows it. The helium is what keeps the Arctic and Antarctic caps frozen. Because they are frozen and rigid, they hold all of the tectonic plates somewhat still, so we don't have radical and violent motions. But since that helium is no longer refrigerating the Arctic, the cap is getting thinner. The first place that you're going to have the heat escape is on the edge of the cap itself, where it is already the thinnest. And therefore, the heat escape from the magma changes the atmospheric conditions. And so you have this Arctic circle to equator. You have a belt of changed atmospheric conditions so that it snows on Miami Beach while it's warm in Barrow. And because everything else starts to melt, all those plates are now in motion. In 1980, it was warmer in Barrow than it was in Miami Beach. And the people who conducted this pipeline business and this transnational business, the Bechtel Board of Directors, Bechtel Corporation, they are now the administration of Ronald Reagan. And they have not only abrogated my rights as a native, but if I do have any rights as a United States citizen, they are also gone. And the trend that these people are taking in law enforcement and other judicial proceedings just bleeds away the rights of everybody.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Walsh, you've made a very complete presentation about land claims. And I found it very interesting. It seems to me that you're going pretty far afield now, and it's not something that comes within my mandate from the ICC.
I have not led up to the reason why I have gone so far afield.
Well, I wish you would bring us back to the land claims presentation you were making earlier. I'm here to listen, and I'm happy to listen, but I'd like it to deal with land claims and the things that I came here to listen to people from this village talk about.
In the dealings of government, the Land Claims Act took away our government ownership and authority of our property, and they gave the ownership of the property to some state chartered corporations. And they gave the government authority to some nonprofit corporations. And it is for that reason that none of these businesses have come to terms and been successful. Doyon Limited lost approximately $83 million since its inception. They talk about a loss from the refinery project. That's only the one big one. All of the rest of the enterprises that they entered have failed. There was only one that was making a profit this year. It was called Doyon Drilling, and it was a joint venture on the Arctic slope drilling oil wells, and it has to close down because the agreements that the financing were based upon said that as long as Doyon has a certain amount of financial and economic credibility, then that contract can stay in force. But since they have lost everything, even that contract has to end. We're looking at a certain number of self-appointed Native leaders who who garnered favorable positions from these privateers and corrupt government officials. They have $90,000 a year income, big houses, cars, boats. They don't even use the boats. And they talk about this and that, about how they're going to help the people. And then they wasted all the money. And in order to cover up the waste of the money, they're beginning to sell leases on our land holdings in order to put some money back on the books to make it look like they're doing good. When the state was given authority over these corporations, they assumed also the right to govern hunting, fishing, and trapping, berry picking, logging, and the places where we can go. That's against the federal law. You can't alienate Indians from the property. And even though they said in 1981 in the Alaska National Interest Lands Act that there would be subsistence preference, they still restrict our use of our food. The Alaska National Interest Lands Act, Land Conservation Act, was an amendment that came out of Section 17D2 of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, where they said that they took away our hunting and fishing rights here, they say they give it back there. And this business about 1991, it says that this subsection shall be, as far as the taxation, shall be effective as of December 18, 1971, and with respect to each native corporation shall remain in full force and effect for a period of 20 years thereafter, or until the corporation has received conveyance of its full land entitlement, whichever first occurs. So we have non-taxable land here until the full conveyance of our land entitlement. If that comes next year, they're going to start taxing next year.
What will happen if we don't pay?
They
just take it.
They just take it. Yeah. Well, they've got under ANILCA, there's, I think it should be said, there's 20 years after conveyance that undeveloped land cannot be taxed.
It's got to be developed in one of these states.
Well, if it's developed, it could be taxed today.
Yeah, and you said it.
Under Sorry, that's that I said developed.
Under the Federal Land Management Policy Act of 1976, they repealed a number of land laws in Alaska.
I'm sad in the bush, but there's one there.
And the repeal date is effective October 21st, 1986. So we can still file for new town sites. And we can still get 160 acres of land, but it's under another land law. It's called Title 43, Section 189, Abandonment of Tribal Status, where it encourages Native people to abandon their tribal relations. They can get 160 acres anywhere on federal land and still keep the entitlement that they would have coming from the tribal councils. This land Act has to be utilized because all the children born after December 18, 1971 have been abandoned, not by the tribe, not by their own self, but by the United States in their own country. And if we utilize this law before October 21st, 1986, we can all have 160 acres. Under the land laws, we can select 8 parcels of 20 acres apiece. It is my recommendation to my native people that we select 20 acres of oil and gas leases, 20 acres of rights of way on railroads, sand and gravel, 20 acres of timber, and 20 acres of strategic and critical minerals, and 20 acres worth of food production places. That way we can effectively tie up our land. At the same time, the state and all of its instruments, including the Claims Act settlement corporations, have to vacate the 1939 jurisdictions that we have already claimed. Under Title 28, Section 2415, which is a statute of limitations on claims, on money claims for trespass, we can claim money damages for all trespasses incurred against us prior to 1966 or 1968 at the time of the land freeze. And after that, we can sue the United States for breach of trust in transactions made after 1968. Or we can all stop fighting about it and just recognize that natives have authority to tax and issue general obligation bonds for development and do a sound plan, an economic plan, such as we have been studying. We can create a world here livable for 8 billion people with the resources we have today if we do it now. We don't have to fight. We can use the space shuttle to launch all those nuclear missiles toward the sun. We can cure cancer. We can have moose to eat. I would like to present these things to the council and to the commission. I have a lot of things here that I haven't even touched on that need to be reviewed because of the fact that they pertain to Alaska Natives and what this commission is supposed to be reviewing. I don't know how I'm going to present it to you because I know you can't copy all this.
Well, send it to me in writing.
Well, I have only one copy of these things, see? And it took me a long time and took quite a bit of money to get these things together.
Well,
I want to give it to you, but I've got to figure out how I'm going to do it and still retain copies.
Well, they were. What I'll do is after we adjourn, maybe you and I can sit down and take a look at them and figure out if there's a way to do it. I'd like to see, to have copies of some of these materials. One other thing that I should say, too, is that I don't allow the hearings of the commission to be used for personal allegations or recriminations. These are made from time to time, but I always order them stricken from the record. And in Mr. Walsh's case, he made allegations of federal crimes, corruption, and racketeering against 5 persons who sat on the Native Council, one of them now dead. And I direct the typist who will be hearing what I say to strike that from the record of the Commission's proceedings. And he also alleged that in connection with the construction of housing here in the village, there was lining of the pockets of the contractors and the politicians. I direct that that be struck. And he also alleged that directors of Doyon were engaged in a cover-up by various means. You see, I'm perfectly willing to hear criticism of ANCSA and of the statute and of things that have occurred, but I don't want the hearings to be used for making personal allegations against those who aren't present. But apart from that, I've been interested in what you've had to say.
There's this file I have here on proceedings, administrative proceedings, pertaining to ANCSA, land laws, government obligations, contracts let for the purpose of aiding us in our government, in our, like this section 2415 claim here, which was supposed to be taken care of by Tananaw chiefs. They contracted to do this job. How am I supposed to tell you about these failures of ANCSA if I cannot tell you how it happened and who ordered it?
Well, you've told me a lot about the failure, as you see it, of the scheme of ANCSA. You've told me how it has, it and a lot of earlier statutes, impinged on the native governments of the people here and their jurisdiction over land, and you've alleged, and you've spent a good part of the evening supporting your case that, to a great extent, these measures were unconstitutional, and that's the burden of your argument. And I think you spoil a good presentation by bringing in allegations against people who aren't here to defend themselves, and that's why I order them stricken from the record. But turning to these documents, I'd be happy to sit down with you, and let's work out a way in which I can maybe copy them and send the originals back to you.
Some of this stuff I have to use right away. See, that's the trouble. Otherwise, I'd let you take the whole thing. But
well, why don't if you? I appreciate that you may have to use it if you are down in Fairbanks. You can take it down, give it to Mary, and she can arrange for it to. She can go through it with you, arrange for it to be copied while you're in Fairbanks, and then returned to you. That's probably the best way.
Where are your offices?
You copied right there again.
Yeah, but it's 25 cents a copy.
It's a lot of stuff here.
See, this is not the. This is just an overview that I have.
Yeah, I know.
Contains is in a big box at the house.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Mary can give you her phone number and address in Fairbanks. That's where she lives and works.
One of the things that hasn't been covered yet is the fact that these people got together to negotiate a settlement, and that the legal proceedings for a settlement are that someone can be assigned or elected to negotiate a settlement, but the consent of the people through an election is specifically necessary to make this a legal document, this act.
Well, we had a meeting at Akiachuk just last week, and that was the argument made by the people there. But I told them, I think I told them, that this was an act of Congress. Congress has the power to legislate. They legislated, and it isn't as if it were something like the Treaty of Session. It isn't signed by Native leaders along with congressional leaders. It's an act of Congress that had to be passed by both houses and signed by the President.
Right.
So it's.
But it purports to alienate all our property.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah,
there is
yeah.
only one way that Congress can do that, and that is with our consent. See, Congress is bound by the same rules that the...
Okay, that's your argument. And I understand it, and it was made at Acciachuck last week. That is that there was no consent obtained from the tribal governments of Alaska for the passage of ANCSA.
No, there was no consent from the people.
Well, consent that they say had to be obtained through their tribal governments. That's the point they made.
Well, the point I'm trying to make is that the federal government itself states that people, that the native people have to have an election before they can alienate their rights or property. That's what the United States says. So how can it convey away our property?
Yeah. Well, that's the point. Well, look, I want to thank you, Mr. Walsh. This has been a good meeting, and I'm glad we heard from the people of the village, and I'm glad you had an opportunity to make your presentation. Excuse me, was there anyone else here who wished to speak? No. Barry, are you going in the boat tonight? Oh, they haven't left yet, eh?
You guys are going to Fairbanks?
Yeah.
By boat?
They're going to the bridge.
Just to Manly. Go up to the bridge?
Yeah. So, well, I think I'll go and find them.
Okay, well, look, you did a good, nice job organizing the trip and the meetings, and that worked well. Yeah, I'll be there. I'll be there Monday morning, and we'll talk about the rest of the schedule. And you've given Bill your card.
Mm-hmm.
You go down to Fairbanks from time to time.
Yes, if I can get some business done with the council, I might go there Tuesday or Wednesday.
Okay. I'll be there Wednesday for sure.
I'll call you.
And you talk to Mary and work it out. Which of these...